Hello and welcome to Gascast. We're back after last month's gap-based excitement, resuming our normal service for our second year of podcasting. We've got a mixed bag episode this month. We're going to be going back to school on lung protective ventilation, finding out why none of our epidurals work, hearing about the National Tracheostomy Safety Project, and finding out what happens when you're not seen by a consultant and then have a cardiac arrest. Some of us will have discoveries, there will be questions, straw polls, and possibly a new feature if we can make Mark angry. I'm Rick Thomas, and joining me once again are Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Rebecca Smith.
Hi.
And Frank Schneider.
Hi, everyone.
So, guys, nice to be back. We missed Bex and Frank at GAT, but are again very grateful to Lucy and June for standing in. So, kicking straight off with our discoveries of the month, Frank, what have you got for us?
Well, Rick, my discovery of the month is got to do with echocardiography and specifically TOE. And I'm in the process of trying to study up for some accreditation exams. And really looking at lots of video clips of TOE and TEE. And as all of us hopefully know, the aortic valve has traditionally got three cusps, and hopefully most of you know that you do get bicuspid valves as well, which are usually or often associated with abnormalities of the aortic root or sometimes the coronary arteries. But you also get aortic valves which have four cusps, and that makes for quite cool TOE video clips, which you can, we can put a link up for one of the ones that you can get on YouTube. And just a very unexpected finding, mostly seen, I'm told, by the cardiologists who presented this in elective TOEs they do routinely, and it doesn't seem to have the same correlation with aortic valve disease as bicuspid valves, but certainly once you've seen the echo appearance of it, you won't forget it.
Wow, well, there's something to look out for. Mark, what have you got that could possibly top a quadricuspid aortic valve?
Well, my discovery, I'm going to rely on you guys to tell me whether it's a valid discovery or not. I was reading my Twitter yesterday and came across a tweet by Ben Goldacre, who's a popular science and medicine correspondent, and he pointed out this article talking about a new polypill, whereby several cardiac drugs have been rolled into one pill, and not surprisingly they've had the expected results on a few surrogate markers of cardiac disease such as hypertension and cholesterol levels. What really interested me about this article though was where it was published. It's in a place called PLOS One, which stands for Public Library of Science, and this is an open access peer-reviewed online journal run by the Public Library of Science, whereby contributors pay a fee to have things published, and then these articles are then open source, freely accessible to everybody on the internet. Now, they do claim to have a rigorous peer review process, but what they are actually looking at is the quality of the methodology and the science in the paper, and much less looking at the outcome and the importance or relevance of a paper. So if it's good science, it should get in, no matter what the message is. And I just wondered what you guys have seen of these type of journals, and do you think they're credible? Do you think this is the future, or do you think this is not sustainable?
I think this is a really interesting point, and I've harped on before about open access to data, and also about how the peer review process may well be changing in sort of 10 to 15 years' time. I think PLOS One is certainly the example about one of the ways that peer review could be entirely revamped. Many people have probably by now seen PLOS One referenced in one of the journals they read, but the business model for this is very simply the author pays. So if you're part of an academic institution and you've produced a paper, you send it to PLOS One with a check, and then they will peer review it. And exactly as Mark said, what they're interested in is the science aspect to it. Is what you've done valid with scientific method? If it is, they will publish it. You've paid the fee. It's out there for anybody to have access to if they can get on the internet. I think it's a really interesting way to publish papers, and certainly being open access. As someone who gets stuck behind paywalls, it's really fantastic to have something where you know you, you know you're going to be able to get hold of it. And in fact, they do release all of their journals under, sorry, all of their articles under Creative Commons as well, which is even better.
Okay, then, watch this space.
I don't know if you guys have been following the Gascast Twitter feed this month, which I have been running, but if you had, you may have seen my tweets about the new Scrubbertron.
I did. Yeah. I liked your photo.
So we don't have scrubs just in a cupboard anymore. We have to go to a machine every day, and you have to put your card next to it, and then you press a button whether or not you want to receive or deliver your scrubs.
Oh, we have one of these at Mount Sinai. They're an absolute pain. How many credits do you get? We get 2 credits.
Yeah, we get 2 credits.
Yeah.
It only came into force. It's been sitting there looming for the last couple of weeks.
And what do you mean? Explain more, because I don't understand what you mean by credits.
So when I go in, I've got 2 credits on my card. I present my card to the Scrubbertron. The Scrubbertron already knows my size, which is something I'll come to in a minute. It then says, do I want to collect or drop off some scrubs? So I press collect, and then a slot opens, and it has a pair of scrubs of my size in the little sort of delivery thing. I then take them. I put them on. Then at the end of the day, I click again with my card on a different Scrubbertron, because there's 2 Scrubbertron machines, one in the sort of on the way into the changing rooms and one actually in the changing rooms. And then I post my scrubs back into the thing, and then I get my credit back.
Okay.
So I've always got 2 credits. So I can be wearing a pair of scrubs and get a second pair of scrubs.
Sounds flawless.
Except for if the machine gets full, then you can't return your scrubs, and then you end up just accumulating dirty scrubs, and then you won't be able to change them. That's my pet hate with the Scrubbertron.
So, Rick, what's your experience on this side of the Atlantic?
Well, I've only used the Scrubbertron twice. My concerns were actually what happens, you know, when you get a pair of scrubs and you look at it and somebody's put them through the wash with a pair of gloves in the pocket or stapled transport to them.
I had one with a large lump of actual feces. And this had been cleaned and ironed. The feces had been ironed into the front of the shirt. And it took me a good 15 minutes with the smell of feces following me around before I realised it.
That you hadn't had an accident.
I had a very, very shitty scrubs.
Someone was trying to send a message, I think.
This had come. It was in a pile with, you know, it was definitely washed and ironed. But
that is revolting.
Oh, well, I want to know what happens if you get fat, or conversely lose a load of weight.
How does it know your size?
Well, actually, because you tell the Scrubbertron at the Royal London comes with a charming and very jolly Irish guy, who's been sitting there for the last 2 days, telling everyone how great the Scrubbertron is going to be, and taking everyone's size down. But I don't think he's going to be there forever.
See, I would worry about that, because I like to go hybrid with a medium top and large bottoms.
Oh, I forgot to ask him that. He said if you lose weight or put on weight, it's not a problem, because there is, in fact, a change your order button on the screen.
Yeah, that's how ours is. We don't have a card. We have a PIN code that you put into the machine, and then it would dispense your 2 pairs of scrubs, and you return them in a similar fashion. But if you want to change your size, if they're out of your size, for example, then, you know, do you run the gauntlet? Do you go larger? Do you go smaller? And you can just choose a different setting on the machine.
But can you order a different size top to bottom?
No,
unfortunately
not.
Slightly pear-shaped like me. I just like you have to have more like the comfort. Yeah.
You've got a bit more,
I don't know what to say.
A bit more junk in your trunk.
So, has it been a particularly bad week for scrubs? Because on 2 days now at George's, there's been like 3 extra, extra, extra large bottoms and 2 small tops, and that's about it.
Well, ideal for Mark.
Yeah, I think I know that ODP. She must be off.
You know what? I actually kind of had half a discovery, but I think I'm just going to leave it with the Scrubbertron.
Cool.
We haven't got enough time for anything else. Well, hopefully that's cleared enough time for Bex to come up with a new discovery of the month after her appalling first effort forced us to start recording the entire episode again. So, Bex, take it away.
Well, unsurprisingly, Rick, I'm going to wow you with a discovery, which is an app. And you can keep it on either your computer or on your tablet device. It's called Papers, and it can be bought for about £12 or £13. It's a really good app. It acts as a library, and you are able to upload all your articles from journals onto it, and then create sort of fairly organized folders. And anyway, it's a great app.
is this an iPad app?
This is an iPad app.
But do you remember all the way back in episode 1 or 2 or something when I told you about Zotero?
Yeah, but that's Zotero.
But the thing is, you can upload all of your papers to Zotero, and when you then come to write your own paper and you're adding all your references, it works as a reference manager as well. So you can just tick your things in, and it's open source and it's free.
Could have saved yourself about 15.
I don't have a third discovery of the month, so suck it up.
How does it differ from just a program that you can keep all your files on, like your PDF files and stuff?
Probably nothing, actually. I just like the way it looks. It's pretty.
Yeah, it doesn't. I think it's a high-tech solution for low-tech people, really. Bex, talking to you.
What I like, I think, yeah, because it's nice because you can highlight the little bits that you want. You can add on notes separately to what you've highlighted. So you can import your documents in there. So we, for example, when we have our seminar and we discuss an article, you can, add all the notes on a discussion of the journal club or whatever, and then store it with the paper. So I think that's quite handy.
No, that is definitely handy. I think most people now consume their journals on some kind of digital format. And certainly for storing them, gone are the days of having an office that was stacked full of stapled photocopies. You want there's a better way to do it. That's certainly one of the options around. Most people nowadays do have a stack of stuff they're saving on their computer, but something that's nice on your iPad that you can annotate is surely going to be a win. How much was it, did you say? 12 quid?
I think it's $12.99, yeah. It's as good as it's going to get for this month.
I hope that gets you the job, Bex.
Well, moving swiftly on from that, why don't I kick off with my article/news story for this month?
Go for it.
So this month, I'm covering a paper from April's BMJ, which was Lung Protective Mechanical Ventilation and 2-Year Survival in Patients with Acute Lung Injury. I wanted to cover this paper for a few reasons. Number one, I think that lung protective ventilation is an important point and something that is worth talking about. Number two, we cover a lot of randomized controlled trials, which this is not, but I think it neatly demonstrates some of the problems, solutions, and reasons to perform an observational study. I think it highlights the significant medium to long-term mortality of ventilated ICU patients, which for people who work in ICU, when you discharge them, you do tend to forget about them unless they bounce back in. And the long-term follow-up of these patients is something that I think ITU people don't often think about, or don't think about as often as they should. I think it demonstrates the difficulties adhering to even the best established guidelines, and there's a good bit of ITU history revision in here. So, by way of background, this paper is of course based on the landmark ARDSnet randomized controlled trial, of which I'm sure you're all aware, but for those people listening who are just starting their ITU, ARDSnet was a randomized controlled trial looking at 6 mL per kilo tidal volume on ventilated patients with acute lung injury compared to 12 mL per kilo tidal volume. The trial was stopped prematurely because the low tidal volume arm showed such a significant survival benefit at 180 days, which was 31% versus 40%. This gives you an absolute risk reduction of 9% or number needed to treat of 11. So the ARDSnet trial was the basis of lung protection ventilation, which we all should know about for ARDS and has since become a very well-known and recognised standard of care. Again, just to remind you, because this is something I constantly have to remind myself of, a quick definition for acute lung injury in ARDS is bilateral pulmonary infiltrates on the chest x-ray, pulmonary capillary wedge pressure of less than 18 millimeters of mercury, a PaO2 to FiO2 or ratio of less than 40 kilopascals for ALI, and a PaO2 to FiO2 ratio of less than 26.7 for ARDS. So for this paper, we know that compared with age and sex match controls, patients discharged from the ICU are 2 to 5 times more likely to die during the first 3 to 15 years of follow-up. ArdsNet looked at 180-day mortality, but what this paper set out to do was see if this benefit was sustained in the medium, or in fact they say long term, so was looking at 2-year mortality. The problem they faced was that due to the success of ArdsNet, 6 mL per kilo tidal volumes has now become a standard of care proven to improve short-term survival, so performing any form of randomized controlled trial is going to be out of the question on ethical grounds alone. Therefore, you need to find a clever way of performing some form of observational study. They chose to perform a prospective cohort study. In this design, a group of similar individuals, in this case patients with acute lung injury, are recruited at the beginning of the trial, so it's prospective, and followed up over time, taking note of the various factors under scrutiny, which in this case are the ventilator settings, up until the study outcome, which here is either survival of 2 years or death. So the recruited patients are then compared for the factors you're measuring, and the researchers try to tease out the various influence of these individual factors. The weakness with any observational study is that it cannot control for measured and, very importantly, unmeasured characteristics between the groups. Measured characteristics you can attempt to account for through clever stats, which is what we're going to do here, but unmeasured characteristics are unknown, and therefore you can't do that. With a properly randomized experimental design, these factors should be taken care of, hence the importance of divulging exactly how randomization took place. So for this study, they enrolled patients diagnosed with acute lung injury according to the criteria we've already mentioned. It was a multi-centered trial, so it took them only 3 years to recruit 520 patients. They declare a sensible list of exclusion criteria early on, such as terminal cancer, then follow the patients up for 2 years with mortality as the primary outcome. Twice a day, they took a snapshot of each patient's ventilator settings and categorized them as either adherent, if they were below the 6.5 mL per kilo predicted body weight and less than 30 centimeters of water plateau pressure, or non-adherent, if they weren't. Interestingly, they also included patients, or they took note of those patients who were using high-frequency oscillatory ventilation, or something I've not come across, which I think is probably not so popular in the UK, which is something called airway pressure release modes. Next, you have to do some clever stats. All of these patients were evaluated for baseline variables, Apache 2 scores, primary risk factors for ALI, along with a bunch of other stuff. The dynamic measured covariates were also collected throughout the ventilated period, and these included the things I've just mentioned, plus use of neuromuscular blockade, cumulative fluid balance, and the presence or absence of delirium. All of this data is then bundled into a term you may have heard or read before when you've seen these kind of studies, which is a multivariable Cox proportional hazards regression model. So in complete noddy terms, and about 2 sentences, what this basically does is create a statistical model of the patient's survival based on the variables we've collected, and allows us to isolate the effect of the variable we're actually interested in, which in this case is the number of occasions the patient's ventilator settings were found to be adherent to ArdsNet protocols. So in effect, it's fairly obvious to make a statement such as, those patients who were harder to ventilate needed higher pressure or tidal volumes, they're obviously much sicker and therefore obviously died more frequently. But using a Cox proportional hazards regression model, we can take this into account and then mathematically estimate what the real size of the intervention we are interested is after these things have been accounted for. So to the results. It's important to bear in mind that each patient recruited may have had a combination of adherent and non-adherent ventilator settings, and what this study was aiming to look at was the proportion of adherent ventilator settings and examine the impact that had on long-term mortality. The first thing that really stood out for me was the overall 2-year mortality was 64%, which I think is pretty huge. Think how many patients you see on any ICU you work on with an ABG meeting acute lung injury criteria. The next thing was that of all the ventilator settings they collected, which was 6,240 readings, only 41% were adherent and 37% of patients did not have one adherent set of ventilator settings at all. This really demonstrates the difficulty in translating well-regaled findings from one of the most famous randomized controls in intensive care medicine into clinical practice. The headline result was, however, as you probably would expect. There was an absolute risk reduction in 2-year mortality of 4% if you managed half of your ventilator settings adherent to ArdsNet protocols, and 8% if you were ventilated in an exclusively adherent manner. And remember, this is taking into account the covariant factors to do with the patient's individual pathology. Looking at the actual mils per kilo body weight as a continuous variable, rather than the binary yes-no, adherent, non-adherent, through regression modelling, they actually found that there was an 18% increase in relative risk for every extra mil per kilo increase in tidal volume. This really is huge news that protective lung ventilation strategy is not only good in the short term, but also in the medium to long term as well. For those of you happier with numbers needed to treat, with 100% adherence, your numbers needed to treat is 12.5, which is really pretty good considering we give everyone paracetamol and the number needed to treat for that is about 4. Other findings which may interest you in this study were that independent predictors of mortality were duration of neuromuscular blockade, so not the total dose given, but how many days a patient was paralyzed for, and unsurprisingly, higher cumulative fluid balance, i.e. those patients who had a higher cumulative fluid balance were more likely to die. Really interestingly, a predictor of survival was being put onto high-frequency oscillatory ventilation. So in summary, not a hugely surprising result, but does neatly demonstrate the difficulty in performing observational studies. There is definitely an important message there about mortality from acute lung injury or ARDS, and remembering to always check and optimize your ventilator settings, not just so your patient makes it through to the end of your shift, but to have a long-term meaningful impact on their survival. There's a large scientific debate about the role of inflammation in barotrauma and volutrauma and the concept of lung rest, but looking into my crystal ball, I think we'll be looking at positive pressure ventilation in a whole new light in just a few years. I think that light will be in the form of high-frequency oscillatory ventilation. And that's the end of my article, so you can switch your microphones back on.
I have a question, Rick, that you might be able to answer. You might have already answered, but the covariate logistic regression, that's the level of maths at which I become baffled, and you just have to kind of believe what they say. But it occurred to me, as you said earlier on, they can't do a proper RCT because it's been fairly well proven that lung protective ventilation works. With that in mind, how do we know that the patients in this new trial who weren't adherent, if they're not adhering in those ITUs to lung protective ventilation, surely that's a surrogate for that they might not be adhering to all sorts of best practice treatments, and therefore isn't that just a surrogate marker from them getting generally worse care all round? Are they all up to date on use of glycemic control and steroids and the various other ICU big deals? There was a high proportion of the patients, you said 30-something%, who were never within the adherent protocols. So maybe they're run by mavericks who don't care about protocols.
I think that's a really good question. And I think there's sort of three aspects to the answer of this. Firstly, and they do state this in the paper, the mortality rates they found amongst their cohort were totally within other published studies. So I think we can assume they're performing at the same rate. The second thing is, the thing about the logistic regression is that it should account for all of the variability within the other standards of care, as long as those are all fairly homogenous, which I think they say they are. So the point of the logistic regression is that it just analyzes the one thing you're interested in, which in this case is the ventilator settings. So even if the other standards of care were really bad, we've statistically isolated the one thing we're actually interested in. And I think the third thing, which comes up from all of this, is how often do you, actually when you see a patient, calculate the ideal body weight, work out the tidal volumes in mils per kilo, and set the plateau pressure appropriately. And I think part of this study was demonstrating how difficult it is to adhere to that kind of a guideline.
No, good point.
With that, I thought before we moved on to our next article, I would go through some feedback we had. We've had some emails.
Ooh.
Stand by. The couple of months ago, before the GATCast, we got quite excited about ultrasound, and one of the things we talked about was ultrasound-guided subclavian lines. We've had a couple of responses and a YouTube video. I did retweet this, but we will definitely link to the podcast notes. But good friend of the podcast, Dwayne Moore, who is a anaesthetist from South Africa that Frank and I met at the World Congress, after listening to the episode, made his own YouTube video of him really, really nicely demonstrating an in-plane technique for doing an ultrasound and subclavian line, which is fantastic. It's really, really clear, really, really shows you what you're going on, has nice annotations and titled at the beginning with "It's good to know what's around the corner." So, Dwayne, thanks very much for doing that, and check that out, because that's actually probably the best YouTube video we've looked at. And then I got a nice email from Segun Olasanya, who is an ST5 trainee like me at the Oxford Deanery. Turns out that for the last 3 months, he's been learning to do them, and he says they're not that hard. A couple of things he does. He does it in plane, exactly the same as Dwayne does, and says the chance of hitting the pleura or artery is totally minimal. And he also says that he finds that more often than not, it becomes an axillary line due to where you put it in. And what he does in a little more detail is he holds the probe vertically, so pointing cephalad caudad like the video we did link to. That helps you identify the subclavian artery at roughly the level of the coracoid process. Apparently it's just like doing an infraclavicular brachial plexus block, not that I've actually done any of those. The vein is usually visible right next to the artery, and it is in fact compressible and non-pulsatile when colour Doppler is used. You then rotate through to 90 degrees, giving you the in-plane view. Keep the vein in the centre, and you get a nice picture, and it's very, very easy to do. And the other thing that Segun says is it's now his line of choice, which is great.
Having met Dwayne, I can quite imagine him running around with his favourite sonocyte machine strapped to his back and applying probes to wherever he could possibly think of using one.
Yeah, it's nice. In the credits at the end of his video, he says it's obviously a sonocyte, but tells you which model he's using, which type of probe he's using, all sorts of stuff.
Does he make reference to the video we saw at WCA? What,
the rehabilitator? No, but I suggest if anyone from Sonocyte picks up this podcast, they should definitely hire Dwayne for their next rehabilitator video. He is a true ultrasound hero. So, moving on. Bex, you've been donning your airway hat this month and been looking at the National Tracheostomy Safety Project. So why don't you tell us what that is all about?
Thanks, Rick. Yeah, this is an article that I read in the July episode of The Bulletin, published by the Royal College, and it was written by a Dr. McGrath. He's one of four founding members of the National Tracheostomy Safety Project. All of the members are either intensivists or anaesthetists and work around the Manchester area. Had a series of serious untoward incidents at their trust involve patients that they collectively term as neck breathers. And when they investigated these incidents, some common complications and themes emerged. And what they noted was that there is a lack of understanding and knowledge regarding the anatomical difference between patients with tracheostomies and those with laryngectomies. So they drew up a set of initial guidelines to facilitate both the routine and emergency management of neck breathers and developed a website to assist in training staff adequately. And then this sort of grew, and as it gained momentum, they got a number of professional bodies from a variety of disciplines to review the guidelines, and now they've evolved into this nationwide initiative. So if you log onto the website itself, it's full of videos, quizzes, and interactive diagrams. And there's three self-directed e-learning modules available. They cover basic knowledge of tracheostomies and laryngectomies, airway equipment and general nursing care for these type of patients, and the management in emergency situations. It's probably worthwhile doing these modules as they're all available for CPD approval. And apart from that, there's also resources available to download and print. So the main thing that they have are bedhead signs to be posted, similar to the way in which nil by mouth signs are posted at the patient bedside. And they're color-coded. So laryngectomy patients have a red card and tracheostomy patients have a green card. And in the case of emergencies, it helps give a visual indication for first responders that are unfamiliar with the patients to immediately be able to ascertain important details like what type of airway their patient has, the date it was inserted on, and important contact numbers for relevant staff, such as the ENT staff. Now, the bedhead signs are linked with appropriately color-coded algorithms to assist in the management of airway emergencies. And there's two different ones for primary responders, and then a separate algorithm for responders that have advanced airway skills. I have to say, this is a really good project for a variety of reasons. For starters, you know I'm a self-appointed cheerleader for all things associated with the Difficult Airway Society, so I was destined to love it from the start. Not only that, but it's free, and they're also developing an app for the iPhone. On a more serious note, from the Fourth National Audit Project, we know that when tracheostomies get blocked or dislodged on a critical care unit, it's associated with approximately a 50% mortality rate. So any attempt to reduce this figure is much needed. And on a personal level, as a junior doctor, I would have found this resource quite enlightening. And I'm sure many junior trainees are unfamiliar with the differences in the types of airways that can be encountered on an ITU. And this website forms a fairly painless refresher course in airway anatomy and equipment. I'd really recommend that people take the time to check it out at www.tracheostomy.org.uk.
Well, thanks very much for that, Bex. Exactly as you say, we learnt from NAP4 that tracheostomies were a big source of airway problems. And the take-home messages for me from that were know your anatomy and give oxygen appropriately. And if you don't know your anatomy, give oxygen everywhere.
Well, exactly. There's nowhere to give the oxygen. So there's no point in a laryngectomy patient for giving the face mask oxygen. And this website just makes it really clear. It doesn't have a huge amount of detail on it, but it's sort of got enough with an appropriate level of repetition. I think once you've looked at it a few times and seen the videos and there's some PowerPoint presentations, you really are very clear in your mind about the emergency management and the routine management.
Well, I think there's a few basic things that you just need to be aware of, have got your head around before treating these patients in emergency situations. And I think the website does certainly provide good resources to be able to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, one thing's for sure, you may be the first person to get to this, and people definitely expect you to know exactly what's going on. So for new anaesthetists starting out with on calls, this is a really good resource, because you may well be in a situation where very few other people know what they're doing.
And fairly impressive, you think a small group of anaesthetists, you know, that were intensivists and noticed an issue locally, have really managed to gain so much momentum and make it into such a nationwide project.
Well, I do want to know if they actually got as far as using an LMA over a stoma to provide primary emergency oxygenation.
There's a video of that.
Is there?
I've watched all 21 videos on YouTube.
Is there anything you can't use an LMA
for? An LMA. Tell you.
One thing that did occur to me when I was reading it was there's a potential hole in the market or business opportunity for somebody. We're amassing so many apps with algorithms now. So DAS have got an app. There is a Resus Council app. They've got an app. If you've got an algorithm, you've got an app. Someone should invent some kind of all-in-one rolled-in app that holds all of your algorithms, or you can add algorithms too.
The mega app.
Or, precisely, some kind of mega algorithm app or algorithm master. Feel free to use that.
Something that can hold all your algorithms together and dispense scrubs for you at the start of your day.
Thanks very much for that, Bex.
Pleasure.
Thank you to everyone who voted in our poll of the month last month, although it's been a poll of 2 months now. Not a roaring success. But the question was, you get called in the middle of the night to a post-op patient in pain. You discover the epidural catheter has become disconnected from the filter. What do you do? And there were 5 possible answers to this. Take out the epidural, if it is safe to do so, and start a PCA, which was the most popular vote with 43%. Wipe the distal 10 centimetres with chlorhexidine, dry and reconnect, which was the second most popular with 36%. Recite the epidural, which Mark said he would do, which is 14%, or something else, which there is only one vote for. And the other one was just reconnect it and continue the infusion, again, which there was only one vote for. So thanks to everyone who voted. Don't think we're going to do anything with that. It's a little hobby horse of mine, because for those people who remember NAP3, you probably noticed that the incidence of epidural abscess formation was incredibly low. It was in fact only double what the spontaneous epidural abscess formation is in a well population who have not had any kind of neuroaxial intervention. But I know from my own personal experience and talking to colleagues that a lot of people come across disconnected epidurals, and then you have to do something with them, and one of the things that people do is this wipe, snip, and reconnect. However, the original paper where that recommendation comes from, if you can be bothered to dig it out, does not recommend anything like that at all. I'll probably come back to this at some other point, because I'm trying to do a little bit of garden shed research on it at the moment, but...
Are you doing garden shed research emboldened by your findings at Gatcast of what you can do with a piece of pork and an epidural catheter?
No, it's actually some phase one research I've done on myself, looking at how to infect epidural catheters when they come apart. I've actually had quite a lot of difficulty managing to do it. I emailed what I'd found to some journal people, and they said it was quite interesting, but they want to see something with ethics, patience, and bigger numbers.
Excellent.
But anyway, at the rate I'm going at the moment, I reckon you can probably lick them and just put them back together and they'll be okay.
Just don't dip it into Mark's scrub pocket.
I was going to say, unless you've got actual shit on your scrubs.
Yeah. Even then, you know, these things are surprisingly resilient.
Good luck forgetting the ethics for that.
Well, yes, indeed. It's probably a good time to remind people listening that anything you do hear on the podcast should not be taken as clinical fact. It's just opinion. And as it turns out, not even always sensible opinion. But anyway, from that poll, Mark, your news item this month is all about epidurals. So why don't you tell us about why our epidurals fail?
Yeah, why not? It's a bit of an unusual article for me to choose, but I'm about to head back into hospital practice, so I can't keep burying my head in the sand for any longer. This is a nice review article from the current issue of the BJA, written by a group from the Academic Medical Centre of the University of Amsterdam. And they're looking for potential reasons why epidurals fail and what kind of things can be done to optimise your chance of successful analgesia. So as I said, it's a review article. They have looked for all sorts of published reports, trials, RCTs, meta-analyses from Medline in the usual way, and put the information together in a nice readable format, which is divided into lots of different sections. So I'm just going to summarise the key points. Obviously there's a lot more in-depth information to be had from reading the article yourself, but here we go. The underlying theme of the article, which they seem to get from lots of the trials I've looked at, is that epidural catheters have a tendency to migrate. I think we all knew that, but some of them reckon that in 24% of patients, the epidural catheter had moved more than one vertebral level by the next day. All right, the next thing they look at in this study is the patient position. So, quick straw poll, what do you guys do, sitting or lateral?
Sitting.
Sitting.
I do a combination, but lateral mostly, I suppose.
Actually, can I retract that? It depends how large the patient is. If they're slim and I think they can bend, then lateral, because they're usually more comfortable. If they're very large, if you land them laterally, you won't be able to find the midline. So then if they're large patients, that's
never a straight answer with Bex.
Yeah. Okay, so what the evidence shows is that sitting has been shown to have shorter insertion times and higher accuracy, but more vagal reflexes and more venous distension, which potentially might lead to an intravenous catheter placement. In the lateral position, apparently you increase the distance from skin to epidural space.
Well, the other thing that this article didn't mention, but I was taught, and I thought it was based on some evidence, was that, and it does make sort of intuitive sense, is that if you're in the sitting position, the pressure, your CSF pressure potentially does minimize the space between the epidural space and the dura, and it does increase your incidence of dural puncture.
But wouldn't that depend on whereabouts you were doing your epidural? For instance, wouldn't that work in your favour if you were doing a fairly high thoracic epidural?
Possibly. I thought that there was some... Wasn't there a study that showed that people who routinely do their epidurals on the lateral, when there's an emergency, say, for example, for obstetrics, they're quicker because they're familiar with doing it in the left lateral, whereas when anaesthetists are used to doing their neuraxial blocks in a sitting position, then they take longer. And so I had always been taught, when I was a junior registrar, that it was better to learn to do them in the lateral, that you were familiar with that, so that you would be faster in an emergency as opposed to doing something unfamiliar in an emergency.
I've definitely had that same advice.
Yeah.
I think that's a good point though. It's the same kind of as the argument about ultrasound for various nerve blocks and line insertions. I think especially as trainees it behoves us to learn as many techniques as possible and not be too keen to decide early that one is way better, especially, I mean, in the absence of solid evidence. You need to be able to adapt and have extra techniques to try when things aren't all going totally to plan.
Yeah, agreed.
And it certainly doesn't mention in this article any evidence about differences in dural punctures or differences in success rate.
There was an article published in IJO about a retrospective study over about 15 years in the UK, and they showed it didn't matter, there was no difference in the grade of trainee, the time of day, the time of night, or the position for a number of dural punctures. So perhaps that's a myth.
Well, the next one's pretty interesting. Midline versus paramedian. I'm assuming that everyone here mostly does midline.
No, I'm a paramedian, man.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. If you look at the anatomy, with a paramedian, you get the angle right, you get your spinous process out of the way, and you've got a much bigger target. And I was delighted when I read what you're about to tell us.
Well, yeah, according to the evidence found by these investigators, the paramedian approach results in less epidural tenting. It results in more reliable passing of the catheter in a cephalad direction, a faster insertion, and less paresthesia than a midline approach. So, all round.
But surely that depends on the level.
Well, I was just going to ask, because Rick, do you do paramedians for thoracic and lumbars, or just for thoracic?
It's my technique of choice for a thoracic, and it's my backup technique for a lumbar. Basically, for none of the reasons Mark said, it just results in a higher number of successful epidurals.
Yeah, you see, I'd agree with you. I mean, I think for thoracic, paramedian is, well, in my hands at least, is better.
But then I think that you're being more careful in the thoracic region already, because your ligamentum flavum is thickest in the midline, isn't it? So if you're on the sides, it's going to be thinner. So you'll have less resistance when you're doing a loss of resistance technique. So I think it's fine when you're in the thoracic area and you're being careful to have a thinner ligamentum flavum. In the lumbar region, you possibly think you're in a place of safety and you might tend to be more aggressive. So if you went to paramedian there, you probably have a higher risk of a dural puncture.
Well, one of the reasons they suggest here is that they reckon that the ligamentum flavum is not continuous in all patients, and therefore the presence of midline gaps might make the midline more difficult to use.
Yeah, fair enough.
Right, so next one, surely this one won't be controversial. the way to identify the epidural space. So is everybody here a loss of resistance with saline kind of person, or is anybody doing anything different?
I don't think any of us are old enough to be any different.
No.
Fair enough. And the evidence would seem to support that. It says that some studies showed an equal ultimate success rate, but 1.5% fewer postdural puncture headaches using saline rather than air. Another study, interestingly, showed that loss of resistance with air needed more attempts, but final success rates were comparable. And in subgroup analysis, fairly obviously, they found that you were better off doing whatever you did most of the time.
I also like what they say about the hanging drop technique, though. Because I think if we're all too old to have done loss of resistance to air, certainly not have done a hanging drop technique.
No, exactly. That relies on negative pressure, which isn't consistent.
You see, but despite them saying that, and they're saying that especially in the lateral position, it's just not worth doing, I have to admit that I still like holding up the catheter and making sure the meniscus is dropping.
I just like it because it's cool.
Because it's cool.
I do that.
It looks fun.
And it gives you hope.
It does. It gives you precisely. That's what it is. It gives me.
You know,
hope.
It's going to be a good epidural.
I see it, and I'm just like, yeah. I also do the second thing. I show everyone, so I've got a witness.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. Did you see it? Did you see it move? Yeah, it's definitely in.
Do you get them to document that in the notes?
So, loss of resistance to saline, good. They say that the various technical aids are available, but none have sufficient accuracy and practicability to justify the cost. Except maybe ultrasound, which is useful for teaching, it's useful for children and for obese patients. Now, this next one surprised me. How far do you insert your catheter? Numbers, please.
I was 4 centimetres.
Yeah, 3 to 5.
Yeah, I was 4 centimeters, but big. I'm tempted with 5 now, having read this.
I was always a 3 up until now. I thought that.
Oh, that's not enough.
No wonder our failure rate is as high as 37%.
No, see, my failure rate's not at all bad looking at the numbers here, but I always thought pushing it in too far meant it was more likely to curl up or poke itself down one side or something like that. And so as long as it was well fixed, I would always go for 3, but here says at least 4, maybe 5.
Well, I thought it said 5 was optimal.
It does, yeah, in the conclusion. Yeah. They're saying around 5 is what to aim for. The studies that they've drawn that from were saying that, you know, one first study said at least 4, and then more recently a study that's saying maybe 5 or more might be even better. Okay, we're getting there. So, test doses. Who uses test doses? You said you do, Bex.
Yep, totally. 3 mils, 2% lidocaine.
On its own?
On its own.
And looking for what, a profound block with motor block that would suggest you were intrathecal.
Yeah, so you're looking for intrathecal and intravascular, aren't you? So you ask after 5 minutes, you know, do you hear anything unusual? Is your vision okay?
Are you about to have
any
a fit?
Strange taste in your mouth? Yeah, you look a little anxious.
But you ask after
the legs, because that'll give you enough. Yeah.
But 3 mils of 2% is not gonna be a toxic dose in anyone but the smallest of pediatric cases.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to give enough that the person actually has a fit. You want to give enough that they will often hear just a little bit, like you'll just have a strange feeling or a taste of garlic in their mouth, or they'll have a
that
symptom.
Is the softest sign in the world.
said
to me right now, do you have a taste of garlic in your mouth? The answer to that is yes.
Especially when you're dealing with such a psychologically challenged group as the labouring.
Yeah.
So where I'm working at the moment, we routinely give 3 mils of 2% lidocaine IV at the beginning of anaesthesia for analgesic effects, and it's just the standard of practice where I'm working at the moment. So we deliberately give it intravenously, and we give it for pretty much every anaesthetic. But people do I feel strange, I feel this. So you are detecting that it's intravascular. They're not twitching, they're not fitting, they're not doing anything major,
so
but they will
the
volunteer
incidence of them
themselves
reporting
so they
symptoms.
Don't feel normal.
What about some adrenaline then, Bex? The authors here recommend a couple of mics per mil.
I think adrenaline would be a much more, I mean, I don't do it, but I think that would be a much more reliable and, to me, convincing way of confirming intravascular placement than a subtherapeutic dose of lignocaine.
We have read the article that suggested that you use this 1 in 200,000 in our journal club. And actually, the idea that you're looking for this increase in the heart rate by more than 15 beats, some studies say 15, some say 30, it's been disproved. It's not a reliable sign.
She's absolutely right.
It's not a reliable sign if it doesn't happen. Obviously, if it happens.
You actually need to look at the T waves is the important bit in peds, because we reviewed this in our journal club for peds. And... And at, I can't remember what age it is, it might be in neonates or infants, you get a massive increase in the amplitude of the T waves. And really noticeable, like on an ECG monitor.
Can I just recommend that you all give your next patient, you give a general anaesthetic to, 3 mils of 2% lidocaine, and they will say something, they will volunteer information to you.
But why are you trying to kill me?
That sounds a little bit like you're advocating we experiment on our patients.
I'm sure is not what you're getting at.
Anyway, let's crack on, because I'm boring myself already with this epidural chat. So, which local anaesthetic to use? Bupivacaine. Should you use opioids?
Yes.
Yep, fine. Should you use some adrenaline for your actual analgesia dose?
Yes.
As well as the test dose? Yeah, I didn't know this. It's got a direct alpha-2 anti-nociceptive effect. It's additive with the opioids you've added, and it delays the systemic absorption, so... sounds like a good idea.
Yes, and so you should actually use it with bupivacaine as well as adrenaline. Even though it doesn't increase it doesn't change your toxic dose, we'll still improve your block, and it apparently reduces the ED95 of bupivacaine. This is what I'm learning.
And Rick, you mentioned this before, bolus or continuous?
Bolus, every time.
Yeah, apparently patient-controlled epidural anaesthesia does result in a lower overall dose and less of a motor block, but no ultimate difference in satisfaction or in obstetrics, the mode of delivery. Apparently the future will be both programmed intermittent bolus administration, so
with a continuous infusion.
Yeah.
Yeah. So An interesting roundup of what's out there with epidurals. The title of Failed Epidural Causes and Management did make me hope it was going to be a little bit more about how to deal with things that have gone wrong, but I think what they're focusing on here is how to get it right the first time. They do reckon that the overall failure rate is up to 30% in various different patient groups, so that means at least one in four of us failing our epidurals, Beck.
Well, apparently Beck has done more than 600 epidurals this year.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mark. I think what we've proven beyond a shadow of a doubt there is that epidurals can raise some really stinky anaesthetic chat. That was.
Also, it's a very emotive topic amongst anaesthetists, isn't it?
You see, there's an obstetric anaesthetist inside everybody.
Yeah, this is what keeps us awake tonight. Actually.
Well, Bex, what I want you to find out, given that you're at Centre of Excellence of Obstetric Anaesthesia, is I want to know more about these midline fat pedicles.
Enough about your personal life.
It's one of the things they quote as being a reason for epidural failure, and I've never heard of them.
That sounds like an excuse.
I think that's a nice way for the need just to explain to the patient. Blame the patient and excuse yourself.
Yeah, you've got that one hell of a midline fat pedicle.
So moving on from something we're all happy to talk about to something a little bit darker. We're very positive generally on this podcast, but we are blessed with having one northern grumpy member of our happy little troop, which is Mark. And no one does a good rant like Mark. So we've decided to introduce a new feature for year two, which we're going to call Mark's Monthly, where Mark is going to have 1 minute to rant about whatever has been irritating him this month. Mark, you happy to accept this challenge?
Yeah, bring it on. Are you gonna literally have a clock and tell me when to stop?
I am literally because I
should have a countdown.
Yeah, I will have I've got on my non-iPhone. Actually, I never use the timer.
I can do it on my phone as well.
Frank, why don't you... Oh, sorry.
Oh, hang on. Frank. Wait.
I could do it.
Oh, actually, okay, so Bex, you're ready. So, Mark, before we start your 1 minute, are you going to give us the topic of your rant? Oh, actually, no, we'll go straight into it. I'm sure we'll get the gist of it that way. So, Bex.
Okay,
are you ready? Do you need a sip of water?
No, to the first of Mark's Monthly.
Okay. Right, so it's going to be on go. On your marks. Right. Sorry. On your marks. Get set. Go.
Well, it's British summertime again, as we can tell from the beautiful skies and rain pouring down on top of us, and that can mean only one thing. It's nearly August, it's nearly hospital changeover time. And, as usual, we will get the usual round of news stories about how it's a dangerous time for patients. But I'm sick of hearing that. It's a dangerous time for patients because it's an annoying time for doctors, that's why. I, for one, have been in continuous NHS service for 9 years now, yet every year, at least once a year, I have to do the same paperwork from occupational health, I have to do the same online learning modules, and the same CRB check. How much is the NHS spending on CRB checking every year? They last for 4 years, but I have to do it every year. I'm so busy I haven't got time to molest any children, for God's sake. They want 6 weeks' notice for our leave, but they won't give us a rota until 6 hours before we start. At least one in seven of you will start on nights after a day of fire training and manual handling, which is only there to prevent the hospital getting sued when you're dragging such a fatty out of the toilet.
You could have got off for much longer.
Very, very good.
You're only really getting going there.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough.
I think you made a schoolboy error in that you didn't take a breath before I said go because you wasted 1.5 seconds taking a breath after I'd said go.
Oh, magical.
You could have gotten at least another point.
Magical.
With retraining.
That's my new favourite feature.
Is that what you were
hoping for? Exactly. We're definitely keeping that in. Brilliant. From that, we should move on to our final news item. Frank, you've been looking at the latest NCPOD report entitled Time to Intervene, something very close to my heart, having done a bit of medicine and quite a lot of ITU. This was a review of patients who underwent cardiopulmonary resuscitation as a result of in-hospital cardiac arrest. So Frank, what advice did those nice people from NCPOD have for us?
Thanks, Rick. Well, like you, well, I suppose we're all involved in these situations. And as an ALS instructor, I'm interested in the ramifications that this report's going to have. So it has just been released. It's the latest report from NCPOD. And as you were saying, it's specifically looking at patients who underwent CPR as a result of an in-hospital arrest. Now, I'm just going to jump, for those of you who want to phase out after this brief introduction, I'm just going to jump to the parts that are specifically of interest to us as anaesthetists, and I am assuming that most of our listeners belong to that population. But just to give you a few facts, they found that more than half of the arrests occurred on medical or surgical wards, which would make sense. 59% occurred out of hours. Most of the cardiac arrests, the cause was, or where the cause was known at least, was secondary to non-cardiac disease. And the initial rhythm was PEA, or pulseless electrical activity, in 53%, asystole in 32%, and VF or VT in only 15%. Sadly, one of the statistics that came out of this is that one in five patients in whom defibrillation was indicated didn't receive a shock within the first 3 minutes of recognizing the arrest. Surprisingly, only 77% of cases had an anaesthetist or an intensivist as part of the resuscitation team. And there were a number of problems identified. 7% of cases had problems with equipment, 6% airway management, and 4% teamwork. Now, just highlighted those because those are probably the kind of problems and causes that we are most familiar with as anaesthetists arriving to cardiac arrests. But if I just backtrack a bit, I'll tell you a bit more about the study. And it was data collected between the 1st and the 14th of November in 2010, and it was part of the NCPOD inquiry. And the study looked at patients aged 16 years or older and was mostly in patient populations and in hospitals in England, Northern Ireland, Wales, and the Channel Islands. And it excluded pre-hospital arrests or those occurring in intensive care units. Basically, I don't want to dwell too much on the methods, but all this data was collected and sent in, and there was an expert group which consisted of a combination of resuscitation officers and emergency medicine, anesthesia, and critical care, as well as cardiology and general medicine physicians, who then looked at all this data. Those of you who are interested in the method of the audit, it's in the report, which is obviously freely downloadable from the website, and goes into even the executive summary goes into quite a bit of detail. They received 787 resuscitation forms and 585 clinician questionnaires, and the assessors reviewed 526 of the cases. And I just wanted to highlight some of the interesting information. But the median age of cardiac arrest victims was 77 years. Most of the patients, 67% of them in fact, were thought to have a disease that was ultimately or rapidly going to be fatal. And many patients had substantial functional deficits, so that meant that they needed help with activities of daily living, and 20% were admitted from somewhere other than their own home. So clearly they were a high-risk category in any case. Most patients were emergency admissions, 83%, but surprisingly most of them, 80% of patients, were admitted during weekdays, and 50% during normal working hours, so they weren't all sort of weekend or out-of-hour admissions. One of the points that they make most clearly is that the initial assessment, which included sort of history-taking and initial examination, was in many cases not as good as we would have liked. And the other point they make is that the time delay to consult and review probably has a big impact on the initial management of these patients. And many of these patients, consult and review in the first 24 hours couldn't be identified in just under half of them, and although there were also problems with documentation, in some cases weren't sure whether that review had taken place and not been documented or whether it just hadn't taken place. And they stressed the importance of an early review or senior review, consultant review, by stating that changes in patient management and interventions were often made after these patients had actually been reviewed. The other thing that I wanted to highlight is that we all seem to be very bad about discussing do not attempt resuscitation instructions, both discussing them with patients or highlighting patients that it would be appropriate to have that discussion, as well as discussing it with the patient themselves or their family, and certainly about documenting it in the notes. That's highlighted by the fact that 52 patients who actually received CPR had a documented DNA CPR decision, and 7 of those were on an end-of-life care pathway, and 5 of those 7 were actually successfully resuscitated to return of circulation when they were obviously subjected to resuscitation attempt, which certainly wasn't in their best interest, and the decision to let them die peacefully and gracefully was clearly probably the resuscitation teams weren't aware of it, but wasn't adhered to. A couple of the other interesting facts are that despite previous NICE guidance with regards to early warning scores and rapid response teams or critical care outreach teams, only 66% of hospitals in the study actually had these teams in place, and highlighting the importance of picking up patients who look like they might be deteriorating and referring those to more senior medics and either registrars or consultants in order to intervene before cardiac arrests actually occurred.
I really like this report. Won me over in the first paragraph by describing how CPR is often inappropriately used, and as you just said, Frank, stressing the importance of early consultant review, and that during this first meeting between the patient and their consultant, for any acute admission, there should be a documented proof of the discussion about CPR and advanced treatments. I think that should hopefully be taken on board. It would make a great audit for anybody just starting out in ITU. Just take a month's patience and find out how many of them have got their first meeting with a consultant on the wards documented, and whether this discussion took place. And hopefully people will start following this advice. We can go to less futile arrests and therefore become more enthusiastic about the ones we do go to.
At least I know of a couple of places where the post-ec ward route includes, and they have a pro forma, it includes a discussion about resuscitation status and why that decision's been reached.
I think we're being too quick to blame the consultants here for being absent. I mean, yeah, perhaps we will get to the stage where we have 24-hour consultant-led care and the medical consultants in the hospital, but there's nothing in that document that says that they were unavailable or unapproachable. And it could well be junior doctors with total lack of insight regarding the need to escalate. I mean, it's just there's no documentation at all, is there?
How about the sentence here, Bex? Where time to first consultant review could be identified, it was more than 12 hours in 95 out of 198 cases, which is 48%.
Yeah, but that is that because they only rang them right at the last minute, that the junior doctors didn't realise how sick these people were, that they sat on them for hours?
No, but this is irrelevant of how sick they are. Surely there are pre-existing standards that all new admissions should be seen by their consultant within 12 hours.
Well, there are. I mean, that's the NICE guidance they refer to, which is very poorly adhered to.
I think it is very poorly adhered to, yeah.
I mean, NCPOD's, you know, there's a previous report that says that each new admission should be reviewed by a consultant. I thought it was within 24 hours. But
that's intensive care, isn't it? It's ICU patients that should be reviewed within that guideline. I think it's ICU patients
No.
12 hours. Is it all patients?
Yeah, the one, I mean, I'd have to look it up, but I'm pretty sure it's not just intensive care patients, because I remember we looked at patients going into renal failure, and one of the problems there was that there was a great delay to actual consultant review or assessment of patients.
One of the statistics they had here was that in 196 out of 230 cases, the reviewers felt there was sufficient data that a DNA CPR decision should have been made.
Yeah.
That's quite astounding.
That is quite astounding. That's nearly 100%.
Yeah.
And I think they also suggest people kind of repeat that type of audit in their own hospital. Look at retrospectively at the arrests you've been going to, and were they obviously futile? You know, use the resources where they can be most effective.
No, that's one of the reasons. I think this is going to be quite a topical report, but I'm sure we've all, and I mean, I carry an arrest bleep at the moment, and certainly a large percentage of the arrests I go to or have responded to recently fit well within one of these categories where a decision should have been made before, or where we've resuscitated someone inappropriately because just not enough was known about the patient, or nothing was documented about whether or not they should be resuscitated.
Well, thank you very much for that, Frank. Very interesting, and a couple of good audit suggestions there too. But it's time to wrap this episode up. So, here's Biology or Bunkum.
Excellent. Gentle reminder that I've won the last two.
Have you?
Well, I was a joint. Well, I was joint winner with you both of you last time, but I was the winner before that.
Were you the sole winner before that?
I won it.
Should we keep a score? And don't you think you should announce it like with a?
Yeah, we should keep a running,
tally
on the website.
Let's start that now because this is the first episode of season two, effectively.
We will from now on keep a tally of who is winning Biology or Bunkum.
Can I ask, are we starting from zero now? So all the wins I've had up and now
don't count.
So everything's nullified. This is a reasonably tough one, I think.
We are drawing a line.
Yeah, we'll draw a line in the sand. The whole of last year was practice round, and this is now this year's Biology or Bunkum Championship with some kind of prize at the end for the winner.
Is it a physics textbook?
So, scores zero all, as it's the first one. Are you listening carefully?
Yes.
Yep.
So, number one. Watching too much TV won't give you square eyes, but it will make them longer. A new study published in the British Journal of Ophthalmology has shown that people who spend a long time looking at backlit screens, so that's TVs or computer monitors, are more likely to develop senile myopia as they grow older. In fact, for every 1.5 hours extra on average you spend looking at a backlit screen per day, participants were found to need glasses to correct short-sightedness 5 years earlier. Number two. Physical inactivity, or laziness, kills as many people worldwide as smoking. A recent paper in The Lancet has demonstrated that there are 5.3 million deaths a year that could be avoided if inactive people exercised, which is about the same as the 5 million deaths annually from smoking. And number three, having children enhances your immune system. Researchers in the US have recently discovered that when the immune systems of parents and non-parents were challenged, parents were less likely to catch a cold, with there being a positive correlation between the number of children people had and the effectiveness of their immune system. Those are your three stories. Rebecca, seeing as you were desperate to make this a competition, why don't you kick us off?
Right. I reckon three is the bunkum. I think that, well, I don't have any children, but when I see colleagues of mine that do have kids, they often seem to be sick. They often seem to have a cold or having to take, do sometimes have to take sick leave. And the reason is given is that they have come down with something that their child has given to them, because usually when the children are in nursery. So I think that's bunkum. I don't think it improves your immune system at all. I think you get inundated with coughs and colds and you probably get run down. And I think one just sounds good. I think television can't be good for you. That's what my mum always told me. And as far as two goes, laziness is just bad. It comes with obesity. It comes with sitting down, eating McDonald's. So I reckon that must be bad for you. You must die from that.
Okay. Mark, you were guffawing during Bex's reasoning. So why?
No, just waiting for the lawsuit from McDonald's there.
And the fact that you've got about a year of good health left before Oscar goes to nursery school and you get really sick.
No, he's at nursery. And,
oh, he's at nursery already?
Yeah, I can vouch for what you said about part three there. But I can only hope that... I'm going to say that one's true on the basis that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger immune-wise.
Are you talking about homeopathy?
That's a subject for another day. We're already way over time here. Number two is true. It was on Radio 2 most of the day yesterday. And therefore, number one, the eye thing must be bunkum.
Okay. Thank you for revealing me as a Radio 2 listener. That'll be it's really going to do my street cred a lot of good. So, Frank.
Well, I think we've managed to reveal that there are two of you that are Radio 2 listeners. But I agree. I think the first one is the bunkum. I think that's got just enough of Rick's scientific fact in it to try and make us think it's true, but it's not. And I would agree with Mark that I think exposure to germs probably does build up, maybe not initially, but in the longer term, your immune system. And we've already discussed number two as being true.
Right, it'll come as no surprise to anybody then that number two is in fact true. Physical inactivity does apparently kill as many people. There were some interesting lines in the article I actually read on this, though.
Just cut to the chase, cut to the chase.
No, no, there are a couple of really interesting bits here. Were you desperate for the toilet?
No, Bex wants to know
if
she's
won. I want to know if I won.
From this, they calculated that if everyone reached their weekly exercise targets, about 6% of those who died globally from heart attacks would survive. I can see that. 7% of those who died from type 2 diabetes would survive. And 10% of those who died from breast or colon cancer would survive.
I'm not
quite sure how to interpret that. I am actually reading off the...
Well, that redefines my entire understanding of sympathy.
and strategy for longevity.
Yeah, maybe this is the one article I found was not... I've got to say, I didn't look too hard into this, but okay. So that...
Was it in the Metro?
No, it's the New Scientist website, which is the Daily Mail of science.
of the science world.
It's another lawsuit.
We're doing well.
Both the Daily Mail and New Scientist.
So, having children does in fact enhance your immune system. I'm sorry,
it does,
Bex. That is
in your face.
Fact biology. They got people with children and then they injected them with various types of rhinovirus and flu virus. And they found that people who were parents were only 48% as likely to develop an infection as people with no kids. So in fact, it's not just a little bit of a health benefit. It seems to be a huge health benefit. And as I said, there was a direct correlation between the number of children you had and the performance of your immune system.
Do you have to wonder where the Ethics Approval Committee was located that approved that study?
I suppose what would be actually quite interesting would be to see, does it matter if it's your own children or if you adopt loads of children?
Yeah.
Or what about comparing parents and teachers? Or what about teachers who have children and teachers who don't have children? I'm going to write a letter.
There's a whole other debate on...
And Bex, the irony of you getting it wrong... was that when I was trying to think of a third news story, the third one isn't based on something my mother used to tell me while I was a child, that watching too much TV would give you square eyes. That is entirely made up. I don't think senile myopia is even a thing.
Oh, really?
Sorry, Bex.
It's just how much attention I've paid. Gutting.
Mark and Frank head-to-head on the leaderboard for this year's Biology of Bunkum, and I certainly am on the edge of my seat to find out what happens in the next 12 months, as I'm sure you all are. So that's it. That's it from us, and thank you very much for listening.